Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to The Third Foot, our monthly bonus episode here at Worst Foot Forward, where, thanks to the kind support of our supporters on Patreon.com, we go back and look at a past topic from the show, or someone who got a mention on the show, or delve deeper into a subject we've maybe not covered in much depth. And last month, Ben, you took us around the world exploring the ancestry of Christopher Columbus.
Yes, I did. It was my own personal version of who do you think you are?
Yeah.
Which, of course, really is a question that should be posed by indigenous people in an incredibly aggressive way at old Christopher Columbus. Just who do you think you are, Christopher Columbus? Coming over here, spreading venereal disease, hacking off our limbs and our heads and enslaving us. To which the answer is, a white European. It's what we do, mate.
Yeah. Europeans be Europeanin'. Well, inspired by that, I thought this month we might look at another one of the great names from history and look at some of the more obtuse and weirder facts about that person. And I've decided to have a little look at Napoleon Bonaparte.
Good Lord. Is this all working up to a Third Foot episode next month of Adolf Hitler, history's most misunderstood genius? A gay and a Jew explore his lighter side.
Hitler versus Jesus. Who was best? Because he's appeared on the show a couple of times, Napoleon. In our World's Worst General episode, our guest James Rowland mentioned him in connection with the advance on Russia and how that sort of derailed his European dominance.
Talking of Hitler, after the start of the Second World War, tried to return the bones of, I think it was Napoleon's son, to Berlin for reasons best known to Hitler. That feels like a real sort of like Sunday night, 11 p.m, too much schnapps. Yes, mein Führer, how are we going to do this? I don't know, just kill a tramp and then put the bones inside a box and tell Herr Führer that it is Napoleon. He's so drunk, he wouldn't know the difference.
God, the German Carry On film franchise was really weird, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But he's one of those people who sort of, he crops up every now and again on the show. And so I thought, well, let's look a little at some of the weirder stories associated with it. If people want to read Napoleon's biography, then go do that themselves. There's all the well-known stuff. I'll just give a little brief.
If people want to read Napoleon's biography, please, by all means, do it, because we have not.
Yeah. But we don't come here expecting to do the headline stuff, by and large. So I've got to give a sort of a quick, you know, gallop through the bits people should know in case they don't know anything about Napoleon. Do you know where he was from, Ben?
He was born on Corsica. He was a Corsican.
He was a Corsican. In fact, early on in his career, he more readily identified as Corsican and was a fighter for Corsican independence before joining the French army. He fell out with the leader of the Corsican resistance and moved to France, and then began establishing himself in the army there, masterminding lots of victories for the French abroad, and then came back in 1799. He'd basically, in the aftermath of the revolution, France was sort of figuring itself out somewhat. It was in an awkward teenage stage, if that's what you want to call the terror. But it eventually sort of had a couple of houses of government, but then it was sort of led by a directory, a five-man directory who were sort of basically pulling all the strings, and a guy called Emmanuel Joseph Sieyès was sort of the dominant figure in that directory. And there was a lot of sort of discontent in 1799. This guy Sieyès thought, oh, this is a perfect chance to maybe, you know, try and seize power. And this guy Napoleon, he's just come back from that great success in North Africa, why don't I get him to help me plan a coup? Napoleon was like, yeah, cool, and immediately started planning his own coup within the coup.
Sorry, is that a coup within a coup?
Yeah. This guy Sieyès thought Napoleon was working alongside him to put Sieyès in charge, sole charge of France. And instead, Napoleon was like, all right, I'll go along with this. But secretly was getting the army rallying around him.
Oh, I like it. I mean, this already makes it feel like Napoleon's career was directed by Christopher Nolan.
Yes. He incepted himself and he took on a position called consul and then declared himself emperor in 1804. And his coronation was quite interesting. Do you know the story of his coronation?
I don't.
So he got Pope Pius VII to come crown him in Paris on the 2nd of December 1804. They had two separate crowns, a golden laurel wreath which sort of, you know, recalled the Roman Empire. And then he had a replica of Charlemagne's crown, because the Holy Roman Empire was basically on the way out at this point, thanks to Napoleon's work. And so he was getting the Pope to crown him, was sort of, you know, suggesting a sort of a continuation of that vibe through him. But Napoleon entered with the laurel wreath on his head, kept it on, so that for the coronation he didn't have the crown put on him at all. And in fact, he crowned himself. He had the Pope there to do it. But then Napoleon was just like, I'll do it. Held the crown on top, above his head, and then put it on his wife Josephine's head.
Wow. And he was extraordinarily in love with Josephine as well, because there's this real sort of contradiction in him, that he was this ruthless strategic genius, quite awkward at parties apparently, yeah, but also wrote these great long romantic tracts to Josephine.
Yeah, I was just about to talk about them actually. Josephine is famously his first wife. He was married twice. Everyone knows Josephine, but he was married to someone after.
Oh yeah, he married a small Japanese conceptual artist, and that's where it all started to go wrong for him.
Josephine was actually, she was previously married to a guy called Alexander de Beauharnais, who was an aristocrat who was guillotined during the Reign of Terror. And so she married Napoleon in a civil ceremony in March 1796.
Yeah, after the French Revolution, it's not going to be a religious ceremony, is
yes,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, at this point, apparently she was quite an indifferent wife, declining to answer a lot of Napoleon's letters. You get that from these the love letters that he wrote to her. He writes things like, I write you, my beloved one, very often, and you write very little. You are wicked and naughty, very naughty, as much as you are fickle. It is unfaithful so to deceive a poor husband, a tender lover. So he clearly was like writing to her lots, and I'll read some more excerpts from his letters in a bit. But she was interested in other things and apparently other people. She certainly seemed to have been having an affair with another officer in the army. Napoleon got wind of it, and when he became emperor, she made sure that he married her properly with religious rites to sort of secure her position within this new empire. And Napoleon sort of reluctantly did that, because they were already, you know, on rocky ground. And he arranged for a nullification of the marriage in 1810 on the grounds that a parish priest had not been present at the ceremony, a technical irregularity that maybe he had already planned just in case he needed to jettison her.
That is the sort of wily strategist in love that I imagine him to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Strategist of love, by the way, was Lou Reed's original title for Satellite of Love.
He then went on to marry a second wife, Marie Louise, the daughter of the last Holy Roman Emperor, because, like I say, he was sort of building up this image of, you know, a great European figure and trying to build a connection to one of the royal houses. So at the end of the War of the Fifth Coalition in 1810, he decided to solidify things by marrying one of the Habsburgs. 19-year-old Marie Louise was married by proxy to Napoleon.
Is that Pope Proxy the First?
Yeah, let's say it was, standing in for, yeah, Pius VII at this point.
Yeah.
She got married in Vienna. She hadn't met Napoleon at this point. Her uncle, Archduke Charles, was Napoleon's representative at the wedding, which must have been weird.
It looks to the uninformed observer like you're marrying your uncle, but the uncle is there representing your future husband.
She's like, well, he's just representing it. It's not weird at all. And then it comes to, you may now kiss the bride. Uncle, stop it! But apparently it was a really fabulous ceremony. Napoleon missed out, apparently. And she became Empress of the French and Queen of Italy. And 2 days later left Vienna to head to France and met Napoleon's sister, who was sort of, you know, put in charge of her until she met Napoleon himself. And went through what is described as a symbolic ritual, which just sounds like a hazing. Apparently tradition dictated that a royal bride coming to France must keep nothing of her homeland, especially her clothes. So Marie-Louise was stripped of everything she was wearing, completely naked. And then Napoleon's sister made her, like, wash all of her homeland off her and was then dressed up again in French bridal clothes. Apparently Marie Antoinette went through the same thing, because she was an Austrian princess who married into French royalty. So when she arrived in France in 1770, apparently she had the same thing. And then Marie-Louise met Napoleon for the first time on the 27th of March. And she said to him, "You're much better looking than your portrait."
Oh, it's like a reverse Anne of Cleves.
Yeah, or a reverse, like, Tinder date, where you go and, yeah, you go, oh, you're not the same guy in this picture. It's like, actually, oh, you kind of are cute.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's basically the history of Napoleon via Tinder, is that he just kept swiping right until he got to Russia.
swipe west, quick!
Yeah.
I mentioned Pope Pius VII, by the way. Napoleon had a rocky relationship with the Catholic Church. In 1801, they signed a concordat, restoring the Catholic Church as the French majority, mm-hmm. but basically with Napoleon in charge of appointing all the bishops and stuff. So he had, you know, control over who got to tell him what to do on religious grounds. And in 1809, they actually arrested Pope Pius VII. They put him under house arrest in Rome. And in 1812, had him snuck out of Italy into France and basically kept him there for a couple of years. They basically kidnapped a pope.
Yeah. That's definitely the title of a good sort of Seth Rogen caper movie, isn't it?
Well, particularly when this is the same guy they've he's invited to coronate him. And who then didn't even let him do the job of putting the crown on his head. And then another 5 years later, he's like, all right, this time we're going to kidnap you.
But the history of the papacy is that sometimes you literally are the most powerful person in Europe. And sometimes you're just a plaything for the true powerful leaders.
Yeah.
But I cannot occupy the headspace of someone who thinks they're capable of ruling a country. I can imagine doing it in a sort of benevolent public servant way, but you know, that's because I'm lovely and naive and know it will never actually happen.
Yeah.
But imagine the size of the cojones on you to go, I'm gonna steal a pope.
Yeah. Moriarty's greatest crime. there's sort of two very split schools of thought about Napoleon. A lot of people are like extol him as the, you know, first guy to impose really liberal ideas in Europe in the wake of, you know, the Reign of Terror after the revolution was a horrendous thing. And then Napoleon comes along and he says his most proud achievement was the Napoleonic Code, which established things like equality before the law and religious tolerance and secular education. And the Napoleonic Code still has influences in about a quarter of the world's legal systems. So it's the biggest codification of laws for a couple of millennia, basically, in Europe.
Bear in mind that global influence is partially to do with colonialism.
Yes.
So when something is spread so broadly, it's not always because of its inherent genius. It's
yes.
more because it was spread with the barrel of a gun.
Yeah, and you have that, and along with, you know, things like him trying to restore slavery in the French Caribbean colonies and things like that.
I did not know that. I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but...
Yeah, the Haiti gaining independence and the slave revolts there was all under Napoleon, of course, and it was due to him trying to reimpose slavery in French Caribbean.
Oh gosh, I mean, that's an incredible thing to think about. I recently listened to a podcast about the Haitian Revolution, the best history podcast, Greg Jenner's You're Dead to Me, with a friend of the show, Athena Kublenyi, on there, all about the Haitian Revolution, and I knew a bit about it, but that's one of the most astonishing facts. It's not just that it was the world's first slave revolt, they did it against one of the biggest dogs in European history.
Yeah, who at the time was laying waste to the entire continent, conquering all before him. He established a huge series of client states across Europe. And basically, there are all these like wars of various numbered coalitions of the different heads of the European great powers trying to stop Napoleon. Obviously to try and protect their own interests, but also to try and go, this is a little bit anti-monarchist and all of our monarchs don't really like the look of this that's taking hold. So it was very much in the interest of the British royal family and the German royal family and the Prussians and all of those to keep this under wraps. Napoleon imposed a thing called the Continental System, which imposed these trade embargoes on Britain. And the reason he went to Russia in the first place is because Russia kept breaking these embargoes because they wanted to keep trading with Britain. It was very profitable. It's, you know, money talks. And Napoleon saying you can't trade with a really important and vibrant trading nation for a country like Russia wasn't gonna really wash. So, yeah, they invaded Russia in 1812 and they destroyed a lot of Russian cities. But the harsh Russian winter meant that Napoleon couldn't really impose a decisive victory. And it was kind of downhill from there. And he was defeated in 1814, exiled to Elba, returned for his 100 days, which we talked about in our World's War sequel episode, and then was exiled to St. Helena, much further away. Elba, if for people who don't know, is just, you know, in the Mediterranean. It's quite near Italy. St. Helena, somewhere down in the South Atlantic. Really, as far away as we can put him.
It's like, the next one after that is like, we're going to have to put him on the moon.
Yeah.
That's the only way. Like, get the Montgolfier brothers, get the biggest balloon we can find and just float him up there.
Yeah.
The incredible thing with Napoleon, and it's something that always fascinates me with history, of the cutoff point when you go from homicidal maniac to great strategic genius, because when you look at what he tried to do to Europe, not that dissimilar to what Hitler and the Nazis wanted to do. Obviously, the Nazis had the horrific racial element and the monocultural element and Napoleon was about conquest, but once he'd conquered you, it was about bringing you under his Napoleonic code, which, compared to the Nazis, which is not a great start to a sentence, isn't that bad. But there's a famous thing he said that, to reference another great historical podcast, Dan Carlin mentions, as well as his strategic genius, it was Napoleon was one of the first, was probably the best pre-World War I leader at turning his military, or indeed turning his state, almost into a factory for the military. And one of the reasons he conquered so many places were because, in his words, I spend 30,000 men a month. So many of his military victories are built on his own dead soldiers.
Yeah, he also reformed the army in many ways. One of his biggest innovations is he introduced canned food to the army. The reason we have food in one of the reasons we have food in cans anyway is Napoleon needed a way of bringing provisions on lengthy campaigns so they wouldn't, you know, decay and waste away. So he came up with tinned food.
So without Napoleon Bonaparte, no Alphabetti Spaghetti.
Yes, correct. That is the conclusion we can draw. A lot of people nowadays have called him Boney, but he has other nicknames, the Corsican, the Little Corporal, and family and friends used to call him Nabulio. I don't know if that's because he couldn't really pronounce his own name or something, but or if it was like a diminutive of it, but apparently he hated it, but family and friends could refer to him as it.
Oh, I love the thought of that, of him being the most feared general in Europe, but when he's around his family and friends, it's like, hey, Nabulio!
Yeah.
It's like, when I'm on stage, I'm generally the funniest person in the room. When I'm with my mates from back home, I'm about the fourth.
Yeah. do you know what side Napoleon was on? He asked in a vaguely QI-type question.
In what context?
What side was he on?
He was on the left side?
No, he wasn't. In fact, one of the reasons it suggests that we drive on the right on the continent is Napoleon.
Oh, okay.
It's certainly true that he imposed the idea of driving on the right across a lot of Europe. And one of the reasons for that may well have been this post-revolutionary thing of everything has to be turned upside down. Everyone used to drive on the left. We've got to do things differently, so everyone's going to drive on the right. And apparently one of the reasons people might have driven on the left originally and on the continent and still do in various countries, including the UK, is that most people are right-handed. So if you're passing on the left-hand side, you can shake hands with one another on horseback, or you also have your right hand free to grab your sword if you're, you know, attacked.
It's all about the sword, isn't it? So
yeah.
So much of modern etiquette and city planning is about giving men easy access to their swords.
Oh, just tell me about it. And according to a book Ed writes, A Left-Handed History of the World, Napoleon was left-handed. So it may have had even more impetus for him to want to change the side of the road that everyone drove on. He played chess against a famous past appearer on this show as well.
Oh, early 18th century. Early 19th century and late 18th century. No, go on.
The Mechanical Turk.
Of course he did.
We talked about this, I think, in the World's Worst Gadget episode. I think we talked about this. The Mechanical Turk was an automaton, which was a robotic man sat at the table that could apparently move chess pieces in front of him and was very good at playing chess, later revealed to just have had a guy hidden inside the table who was moving things around. But the Turk in the early 1800s was owned by a guy called Johann Nepomuk Maelzel, a Bavarian musician who was very interested in machinery. And Napoleon visited the Schönbrunn Palace, which I think is in Vienna, in 1809, specifically to play the Turk. And according to eyewitness reports, Maelzel, this guy, made sure to prepare the machine correctly, and it saluted Napoleon before the start of the match. And there are various different eyewitness accounts about what happened. A lot of them contradict each other. The general consensus is Napoleon definitely lost. There is one story that Napoleon attempted an illegal move and the Turk returned the piece back to its spot. Napoleon attempted it again and the Turk moved it off the table entirely and took its turn. And Napoleon attempted another time and the Turk swept its arm and knocked all the pieces off the board. Napoleon was so amused that he then played a proper game again. So he seemed to be testing it.
Of course he was. He was looking for weak spots. I mean, I'm surprised that Napoleon didn't just push all 8 pawns forward and sacrifice them and then somehow won from there.
Yeah. Another story suggests that Napoleon was very unhappy at losing to it, played it again, played with a magnet on the board, played with a shawl around the head and the body of the Turk to try and stop it seeing. I've got to beat this thing, like Garry Kasparov against Deep Blue. What's the most famous physical trait we know about Napoleon?
Well, apparently he was short, but he was not.
He wasn't terribly short. No, he was 5'2" at the time of his death, which is about 5'6.5" in modern units, which is a pretty average height at the time, to be honest. French units at the time, it was 5'2", but it's 5'6.5" nowadays.
It's like dog years.
Yes, so like, yeah. French inches and dog inches. But one bit of him was quite short. This bit was more profitable than Microsoft shares.
Wow.
Napoleon had a small penis, apparently. It was cut off during his autopsy by a doctor, Francesco Ottomarchi, in front of 17 witnesses. It was acquired by a priest, Abbe Agnes Paul Vignali, who it was giving the last rites, and it passed to his family and various people bought it. And in 1977, it was purchased by a urologist in America, whose surname was Latimer, and he paid $3,000 for it. Apparently, Time magazine said it measured 1.5 inches, so the price was based on an unconventional appraisal where each half inch was worth $1,000.
Yeah, but hang on, that's 1.5 French inches, so yeah. He's actually
massive.
Packing a huge schlong.
Tony Perrottet, in a book called Napoleon's Privates, 2,500 Years of History Unzipped, said it was in a little leather presentation box. It had been fried out in the air. It hadn't been put in the formaldehyde, so it was rather the worse for wear, a bit like beef jerky. But the interesting thing was, and later on, someone apparently tried to buy it for $100,000, which would have been a return on the investment of about 3,200%. In March 1986, Microsoft's stock was priced at $21, and in 2018, the stock price was about $108. That's a 500% return on the investment over more than three decades, making Napoleon's dick 6 times more profitable than Microsoft. And the same applies to Facebook and Google and even Apple. So guys, invest in the penises of dead emperors.
However, which has been more destructive on the future of Europe, Napoleon's dick or Facebook?
He is the subject of a proposed theme park, Napoleon Land, which is estimated to be completed in 2023. And I mentioned as well his love letters. Well, Napoleon begged Josephine to join him in Milan in 1796, saying, "I shall be alone and far, far away, but you are coming, aren't you? You're going to be here beside me, in my arms, on my breast, on my mouth. Take wing and come, come, a kiss on your heart and one much lower down, much lower." Sexy! "Adieu, adorable Josephine. One of these nights your door will open with a great noise as a jealous person and you will find me on your arms. You know that I will never forget the little visits. You know, the little black forest." Ugh, gross. "I kiss it 1,000 times and wait impatiently for the moment I will be in it." People in the past were hella sexy. But he was getting, you know, obviously rumours about her being unfaithful to him. And he wrote to his brother about his love failing for Josephine, saying, "The veil is torn. It is sad when one and the same heart is torn by such conflicting feelings for one person. I need to be alone. I am tired of grandeur. All my feelings have dried up. I no longer care about my glory. At 29, I've exhausted everything." And embarrassingly for Napoleon, the British got hold of that letter and had it published in all of the newspapers.
Oh, yes, please. That's just the sort of underhand thing I expect of the British imperial system at its height.
Yeah, and so clearly, quite a romantic guy. I've got to leave you with this. What do you think a romantic guy like Napoleon made use of these emotions and these feelings in his spare time to do?
Embroidery.
He wrote a romantic novella. There is a 40-page... romantic novella by Napoleon, which has been unearthed and was published in 2009. It was in lots of different fragments. Various people had bits of it, and they were all collated in the 2000s and were published in 2009. It's called Clisson et Eugénie, written by Napoleon. He wrote it in 1795, and it's a fictionalized account of a doomed romance of a soldier and his lover.
Right, what you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, actually, this is a little bit before Josephine. He was actually briefly engaged to a woman called Eugénie Désirée Cléry. The engagement broke off and he married Josephine. This woman, Cléry, she went on to marry Charles John, the King of Sweden and Norway, so she didn't do too badly for herself anyway. But the plot of the book is Clisson is a heroic revolutionary French soldier. He's tired of war. He meets and falls in love for Eugenie at a public bath, as you do. And we have a nice little depiction of the bath. The spa baths at, this is from the book, the spa baths at Alais are 1 league from Champvert. Many went to enjoy the coolness of the climate. Clisson found there an emotional landscape. It was a place of enchantment, and he missed not a single day. Unknown as he was, he wandered amongst the crowd of good people. He gazed with interest at the beauty of the women and their dresses, mostly made of linen. He's just a peeping Tom. People feel comfortable while taking the waters, and he was able to engage in a great number of inconsequential conversations, which brought him relief from his melancholy and solitude. God, Napoleon was like... he's like Edward Cullen in Twilight. he meets this woman, Clisson, there. They marry. He retires in the military. They raise lots of children in a countryside retreat. But Clisson feels compelled to return to serve his country when war raises its head again. He's injured in battle, and a comrade sent to reassure his wife seduces her, who stops sending him letters. You can see this deep-seated fear when Josephine stops writing to him. It's baked into him. You know, so he's heartbroken at the end of his marriage, and he sends one final letter to his unfaithful wife and his traitorous friend, and then deliberately engineers his own death by going in at the front of an armed charge towards the enemy. So it ends tragically.
Yeah, it does. Tragically, but dramatically.
Yeah, right?
I also feel like we could... there's room for an exhibition of art created by homicidal maniacs of Napoleon's novellas, Hitler's watercolors, Genghis Khan's art installations of piles of skulls.
He was very much a predecessor for Damien Hirst, wasn't he, Genghis Khan? So there you go. You can find Clisson and Eugenie drawn together by a guy called Peter Hicks, and a British historian, and Emily Barthes. They compiled the current reconstruction of it. Apparently, Napoleon made 5 different attempts at writing the story. There are lots of drafts, and they've got this definitive edition, which, as I say, is about 40 pages long. So, yeah, Napoleon, for all of his, famous conquerings and things, he was an odd guy. Apparently, he was afraid of cats. That may or may not be true. But there are a lot of people down through history that people say were afraid of cats. I think Julius Caesar is another. So it may be, conflated stories. He also couldn't concentrate if the door was left open. I'm a bit like that. Ate food very quickly. I'm a bit like that. And walked the streets dressed as a pauper to see what the common man thought of him. That's basically me on Twitter.
Yeah, it essentially is. Have you ever attempted to inadvisably invade Russia?
Oh my God, am I Napoleon?
You might be.
Wow, what a bombshell to end on. That is it this month for our Third Foot episode, our bonus episode. As I say, thank you to our people, the people who sponsor us on patreon.com. If you want to get involved with that, go to patreon.com/worstfootforward. We can find all of the various targets we have there, all the little bonuses and treats that you guys will get for supporting us to various monetary amounts. And as ever, you can get in touch with us, as many of you have been doing lately, on Twitter, on @worstfoot. I'm on @BazMaxDay. Ben is on @BenVandeveld. And you can email us on worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com if you want to get in touch with us at length, longer than 280 characters. To Russia, I say. Wow, this is really taking hold in me.
It really was. Au revoir, mes amis.
Bye-bye.